Hi, I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. This hour of the program, should college athletes get paid? Ending the debate once and for all. Patrick Ruby has written a piece asking that question in The Atlantic. To pay or not to pay, he says, is a question facing big-time college sports and a question born of disparity. Football and men's basketball programs generate billions in revenue for an intercollegiate athletic industrial complex, yet receive a paltry cut of the profits via scholarships. The NCAA pocketed $771 million in TV money for its just-completed men's basketball tournament. Defenders of amateur purity say pay-for-play would destroy campus sports as we know them. Fiscal reformers say that the status quo is both unfair and tenable. Both sides are passionate. Both are largely well-intentioned. Both tend to give short shrift to the obvious. We'll be welcoming phone calls for Patrick. The number is 800-486-8655. The email address is talk@wpr.org. Our phone lines are already going. I assume you have pretty strong thoughts because people do one way or the other. Hello, Patrick.
Hi.
Thanks
for having me.
Thanks for being with us. This is an amazing amount of money. When you talk about the amount of money floating around here in sports and college, $771 million just in TV money for the NCAA tournament. $771 million. Wow.
It is rather remarkable. I mean, if there was a college football playoff that everybody wanted, I mean, you could expect that to probably double the amount the basketball tournament gets given the popularity of college football. So, I mean, the audience is out there for the men's, you know, basketball and for football, and the advertisers are willing to pay, and it's very lucrative for these TV networks. I mean, they don't really bid on these things to lose money. So, yeah, it definitely shows you sort of the market demand for this product.
Oh, no doubt about that. College athletes, you write, are already being paid. In what way?
Well, that's kind of the thing I say that the obvious thing gets ignored is that the college athletes are being paid under the table, for lack of a better term. I mean, there's a series of scandals, and these are just the scandals that come to light. Most of the stuff never really comes to light. It's very difficult to prove. It's very difficult to report on. You don't have law enforcement really going crazy trying to crack down on it. But, you know, in the last, just this last season alone, I mean, you see Cam Newton, Heisman Trophy winner at Auburn. You know, his father allegedly solicited $180,000 from another school, not Auburn, in potentially for exchange for, you know, Cam Newton going to play there. Football players at Ohio State, you know, they were suspended just about a month ago. They're actually suspended going into next season for selling memorabilia and for receiving discount tattoos from a tattoo parlor. Just in a week on HBO's Real Sports, an excellent program, a number of former Auburn players said that they were given cash while being recruited by a school and while playing for the school, including something called the post-game money handshake, which is pretty self-explanatory. You know, you put out your hand and a booster shakes it, and whoa, that's where that $500 come from. So, and this isn't new. If I point out my article, you see this in like early 20th century Ivy League football. You see this with John Wooden's great UCLA teams. Part of why they were great is because they had this guy Sam Gilbert behind the scenes who was a super booster and was taking care of all these kids. You see Reggie Bush at USC. He had to return his Heisman Trophy. There was a whole cash and agent scandal there where agents were funneling him money and funneling money to his parents to live in a really nice house.
Mm-hmm.
There's basically an underground economy here. And it exists, you know, like all underground economies exist, because there's market forces that are still there, even though the law says otherwise.
Right. And yet we want to have this vision of young people who graduate from high school, they get scholarships to college because they're great performers, they're great athletes, and we want to keep them pure until they enter a professional world. There's something jarring to people about college students being given that kind of money for playing a sport.
Oh, you know what? There definitely is something jarring. And I would question people that feel that way. What do you mean by pure? And where do you get that idea from? And I'll put it to you this way. if you were a really talented musician, maybe, or a really talented actor, and you go to college, like, let's say you're Natalie Portman and you're going off to, I can't remember which Ivy school she went to. Let's say she's in school and
she's at Brown.
And let's say that maybe she's doing school drama, but she's also acting in the movie and getting paid millions for that. Nobody would have a problem with that. No one would say that her acting is somehow impure. If you're a talented, let's say you're a talented musician, I don't know, let's just say you're playing gigs on the side for beer money. But you are, in the school band or you're in the school music program and you're performing there as well. Would anyone say that your music was less pure? But somehow we have this notion of amateurism that only applies to athletes. And I really question that. I question the historical basis of it, and I question any utility it has, in the current environment.
Except that it always happens with people in sports. It's not musicians who are making the extra money. It's not drama students who are making extra money. It's always sports.
Well, there's more of a market demand for these college sports. I mean, that is true. I mean, people, there isn't as large of an audience that is willing to pay money to watch the average college garage band as compared to a college football team.
Right.
Like in my column, I'm not arguing that these schools and these athletic departments should pay these players. There's a number of reasons that that's frankly impractical, taking any kind of moral argument out of it. But I am arguing that the other money that's available from this underground economy should be decriminalized, so to speak. It should be made available to them. And I personally don't think that there's a moral problem with that.
How do you deal, though, with some schools that aren't as good as others, that don't have as much money? The alums don't make as much money. There are some schools that are really top-notch in sports and others that aren't. So what do? You pay those who are at those top-notch sports schools more money than if you're at a Midland school or a low-performing school?
Well, I think you see that already. I mean, the truth of the matter, and people, I guess maybe people who are fans don't like to look at it this way, but if you step back and look at it truthfully, the schools that generally do the best on the field, that attract the best high school athletes, that produce the most, NBA and NFL players, these are the big-time schools that have the most money. I mean, a place like Ohio State, their athletic budget is over $100 million per year for the athletic department. Their football team is bringing in, I don't have an exact number in front of me, but it's, tens of millions in revenue. I know, in the SEC, a place like Auburn or Alabama, those teams are bringing in $50, $60 million in revenue in football every year. There's already a disparity. There isn't a level playing field in terms of schools having, equal access to the best high school players. The best high school basketball players end up in North Carolina. They end up at Duke. They're not, in general, they're not ending up at Brown. They're not ending up at Yale.
Mm-hmm. And where does
Just to continue that point, I don't think that what I'm proposing would actually change sort of the recruiting playing field very much at all.
Where does all that money go, that $50, $60 million, $100 million a year that's generated? How does it get?
That's a really good question, and that speaks to why just having schools pay players outright is impractical, because much of that money goes to subsidizing all the other sports that don't generate money.
Mm-hmm.
So lacrosse, field hockey, men's and women's soccer,
mm-hmm.
gymnastics, swimming, diving, tennis, all the other college sports you can think of that still offer scholarships or offer partial scholarships or some scholarships, that still travel, that still put on events, that still exists, and in theory exists for the benefit of these student athletes. Those sports aren't generating money, and they're subsidized. It, in some ways, it's sort of like a welfare system. And again, personally, I think that's good. I don't see a problem with that. I think that's kind of a smart way for colleges to set things up.
Let's go to phone calls. We have many of them, and start with Ben in Milwaukee. Hi, Ben.
Hi. I just wanted to, this is kind of related to the last question, but I don't actually have much of a problem with the way the system is now. I don't think it's great, especially for sports like football. where kids are basically putting their livelihoods on the line for a very small chance at a payoff. And even if they do make the NFL, they're going to get likely about $300,000 to, you know, give up years and years of mobility and brain function. But my issue is that with the schools bringing in these hundreds of millions of dollars, I mean, like, look at UW. It's like, how much money must they make a year off football, hockey, basketball, you know, really strong teams in all these sports, yet tuition for in-state residents is going, you know, Biddy Martin wants to put it up at least 10% this year. I think that the money should go towards making school affordable to all students, not just student athletes who get recruited. That's my point.
All right, Ben, thanks.
Well, I think that that's a very, I mean, especially coming from anyone who's in a student perspective, I think that's a great point. Something to note about that, that's a complex issue because different schools set things up differently in terms of public schools, private schools, various institutions. They're all set up a little differently in terms of exactly what they do with the money they generate from the sports that produce revenue. In some cases, you know, these athletic departments are almost like freestanding entities. You know, they're all tax exempt, and they sort of, the money they make sort of plows back into the athletic department. In some cases, you have schools where, you know, one of the dirty little secrets about big-time football is there's sort of a clutch of, you know, maybe 30 to 50 really big-time schools that make money in Division I football, and the other schools sometimes actually lose money fielding Division I football teams. And one of the dirty little secrets is that a lot of times student activity fees are levied to help pay for this. So sometimes even the so-called money-making sports are actually subsidized. And when they're subsidized on the back of the other students, I can see the point of like, hey, this isn't really fair. This isn't right. This doesn't really go to the educational mission of a university. In terms of the really money-making programs being able to turn around and help subsidize the students who aren't athletes, I don't have a problem with that per se, but a lot of that money is already being used for these other sports. So if you're going to shift it over just to students in general, you might have to say goodbye to things like tennis and swimming and diving.
What about the fact that these students, most of them, are getting a free ride through college? That's no small change here we're talking about.
No, I completely agree with that. There is a financial value to that. And in fact, anybody with college-age kids or thinking about the future having college-age kids knows just how high those prices are and how they keep going up. So there is a value to that education. Now, a lot of people will argue, and they make some very good points as well, that for the big-time college athlete, there's not as much value to education as there might be for the average student. The reason being, while these athletes do get some tutoring and academic resources that maybe aren't always available to the average student, they're also oftentimes pressured into taking, I don't want to say rocks for jocks courses, but they're pressured at taking the academic path of least resistance. There's a lot of stories out there about this.
Sure.
And on top of that, this is something else that people don't really understand. If you're, you know, if you're any kind of college athlete, it's a huge time and energy commitment. But especially if you are a football, a men's basketball player, where you're essentially playing semi-professional sports, it's not just a full-time job. It's a draining full-time job. It's mentally and especially physically draining. And to try to be a good student on top of that, even when you're young and full of energy, is actually really difficult. And I think a lot of people that have worked their way through school with either full-time or part-time jobs can probably relate to that. And if they work their way through school with an incredibly physically demanding job, I think they can relate to that even more.
Let's welcome phone calls, more of them, after we pause for just a moment. Patrick Ruby is our guest and has an interesting piece in the current Atlantic Monthly. Should college athletes get paid? Ending the debate once and for all. Patrick is a frequent contributor to ESPN.com, a former staff writer for The Washington Times. His work has appeared in The Atlantic Online and The Best American Sports Writing. He's a graduate of Georgetown University and has a master's in Northwestern and he specializes in writing on a wide variety of sports-related subjects. So we're continuing calls. 800-486-8655. Email is talk@wpr.org. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Returning to phone calls now, we go to Kenneth in Janesville. Hi, Kenneth.
Hello. How many of these athletes even get a diploma out of the deal? And what about the large percentage of the athletes that are injured for life, on the way, I mean, disabled for life,
Those are really good questions. To get to the first point, the graduation rates, when you take a look at them across the board in the big revenue sports, men's basketball and football, they often leave something to be desired. Now, not to play devil's advocate, the graduation rates for the general student body at a lot of schools are also not always especially high. Especially, you know, usually the larger the institution, the lower the graduation rate is. There's a lot of reasons people don't necessarily graduate from school. But in the case of these revenue-producing sports, there's a good argument to be made on both ends that, one, these athletes are under so much strain and pressure, like I talked about in the previous segment, that it's very difficult for them to sort of get something good academically out of this exchange. Secondly, because there's such competitive pressure to win, there is often a lot of pressure to get athletes into schools that maybe aren't prepared to be at these schools. That's probably a whole other hour of discussion. That's been a long-standing debate in college sports.
Yes.
To get to your second question about what happens to players that are permanently disabled or hurt and unable to play anymore, that's a great question. I'd like to say two things about it. First of all, scholarships in the NCAA, people don't maybe realize this, they're on a year-to-year basis. Now, it's generally considered bad form to yank a scholarship from a player. Part of the reason it's considered bad form is that it makes it more difficult to recruit other players down the road if you have a reputation for this. Now, that said, a lot of coaches have a way of sort of letting players know that their services won't be needed anymore and sort of forcing them out without publicly forcing them out, which is, again, that's something you could spend an hour talking about. Something I don't necessarily think is particularly above board or ethical. A lot of times players that suffer a career-type injury, they can and are able to finish their education. Now, if these players suddenly became employees of these schools where they were getting paid a salary to play, it would open a whole can of worms in terms of insurance, workman's comp,
and
it would just create more cost and more complication. I'm not saying that can't be worked out because obviously universities have all sorts of employees and have all sorts of arrangements like that. That's one more thing that a lot of times people don't think about when they just say, we need to pay these guys. It's not fair.
You also, in the article, asked these questions that somebody else asked, the president of the NBA, I think. What happens when they become employees? Can they collectively bargain? Which, of course, they couldn't do here in Wisconsin, but maybe they could at other schools. Do injured players receive workman's comp? Are players at state schools eligible for subsequent retirement benefits? Do only football and men's basketball players receive salaries? Those are pretty big questions.
Right. And as I said, it does open a can of worms just to say flat out, we should just pay these guys.
Right.
Because, I mean, I really understand the moral and sort of the argument from fairness in that case. I mean, it does sound much more fair. But, you know, the devil's always in the details. And I'm not a legal expert. I'm sure these things could be worked out. They could be negotiated. They could be hammered out. But just take, for instance, the whole collective bargaining thing. I mean, a lot of times with college athletes, you're dealing with some of these guys are minors and some of them are not. How would that work? You know, if you're a 17-year-old coming into a school, do you suddenly join a union? And they're only there for 4 years. How does that affect things? I mean, again, you could probably base some of these models on what you see in professional sports. But then are we going to have college sports work stoppages? Are we going to have lockouts? Like, universities going to decide, hey, we're giving too much of our revenues to these players. We're going to lock you out. Can a college lock out its own students? You know, or would it only affect it on the academic front? I mean, there's so many things that you can't really, consequences that are possible but hard to foresee, that it could be pretty difficult. The other thing that would be strange is, who's going to figure out the actual salaries for these guys? Let's say you paid players salaries. Well, someone like Cam Newton has a lot more market value than, say, maybe a third-string offensive lineman. So are the players going to set a salary scale for themselves? Are the coaches? How does that work? That would also open a can of worms.
Right. Thanks, Kenneth, very much for your call. We go to Mike in Milwaukee. Hi, Mike.
Good morning. I understand the arguments for and against, but I also think that we have to look at history. And anybody who's old enough to remember 1984 Summer Olympics in Los Angeles, when Peter Uberoth corporatized the Olympics, I think it took a step backwards and really took the amateur status out of the Olympics and made money for a lot of organizations. But the Olympics have never been the same. They just basically have gotten so much more political. And I can't imagine paying athletes in 17 to 22 year old age and allow them to have the college experience that I and many other people in the 70s or 80s or 60s experienced. I think once you introduce payment into college athletes, greed will ultimately take over. And what about that lacrosse girls team in a small little state school that basically does it for the fun of it? Are they going to be eliminated because they're not a revenue enhancement sport? And how do you get it? You know, it's just you open up way too much complication. I think athletics is not a priority in life. It's still entertainment. And when we can't figure out how to do health care and education right in this country, why should we give a darn about athletics and entertainment?
Well, he makes a good point, Patrick.
Well, that was a lot of complex, a lot of things packed into his comments.
Mm-hmm.
I'm going to try to address a few of them. The last point about why should we give a darn about entertainment, I think that's true. You can say it about every form of entertainment. But the fact of the matter is, you know, we vote with our wallets, and we do care about entertainment. That's also a part of life. And I'm not trying to say morally we should care more about it. And I think everybody would agree the country and the world would be a better place if we all cared a lot less about, you know, making jump shots and cared a lot more about, like, how the healthcare system actually works. But we have to work with the world we actually live in and what people show they actually care about. That being said, there's two things that I want to pick up on from that comment. The first was, this is a little bit random, but the idea that the Olympics became more political when corporate money sort of flooded in more after the 84 games, I think that's very, very debatable and dubious. If I recall correctly, there was a very politically motivated boycott of the 84 games by the Eastern Bloc, and that was in retaliation for a U.S. boycott of the 80 games, which was all about the Soviet invasion of Afghanistan and the Cold War. And I also think if you look back to the infamous 1972 gold medal basketball game between the U.S. and the USSR, and the controversy around that, it's clearly also a very political thing. If you look at the guys in Mexico City raising the black power fists, that's political statements don't get bigger than that. To say that the Olympics have become more political, that they shouldn't be political, I think is to misapprehend the reality that by dint of them being a competition between nations, they are always going to be political to some extent. Now, to get back on the topic, the idea that once you introduce payment, greed takes over, I would argue, like I said, that there already is payment. There's already underground payment to these athletes. There's already an underground economy. There is an above-board economy of coaches making millions and millions and millions of dollars. That's something we haven't mentioned. When the athletes are forced into an underground economy, the money has to go somewhere. It's right. Kind of like when all this money you know, from low interest rates from the Fed flooded the American economy in the last decade. Well, why did the housing market go crazy? Well, the money, you know, there's a lot of complex reasons, but the simple reason is the money has to go somewhere. You look at the college game, you've got these coaches making $5, $6 million a year.
Unbelievable.
Right, and that's not just their salaries, they're also making a lot of money from these shoe contracts. Another thing that was great thing HBO pointed out, if you're, say, Mike Krzyzewski at Duke, and you know, Nike wants to put Nikes on all of your players, well, they can't pay the players, so who do they pay? They pay the coach, and he wears a small, like, Nike pin on his lapel.
Mm.
No, nobody is looking at Coach K's Nike lapel pin and deciding, I want to buy a pair of Nike high tops. You know, we all know what that's about. So I would just say to him, the last caller, you know, greed takes over. Greed took over a long time ago. Greed's always taken over. That greed is human nature. And I don't mean to be cynical about it, but it is. I mean, we live in a capitalist economy. Greed is a motivating factor for good and for ill. I'm not saying that means that we shouldn't try to put parameters on greed, that we shouldn't try to set up a system that harnesses greed for good instead of bad. But I think he has a bit of a romantic notion about things that doesn't square with the reality.
Hmm. You know, the thing that everybody likes is free food. I think we ought to just give free food. No, it's true. It draws people to events. You know that from where you work.
I'm a sports writer. I always endorse free food.
I know. So you just give everybody free food for a lifetime. Free dinners, you know? That'd be a draw. It's simple things sometimes. You don't have
right.
to cook. You,
right.
you got good food.
Oh, as a former college student myself, I think I was more envious of the training table for some of the basketball
yes.
players at Georgetown than
yeah,
I was
right.
of their social status or their ability to jump really high and dunk a ball.
I'm with you. Thanks, Mike, very much for the call. We go to Daryl from Couderay. Hi, Daryl.
Good morning, Patrick and Kathleen.
Hi, Daryl.
Good morning.
I have two short questions, which I believe answer themselves. And a comment. The question is, what percentage...
I like the questions they answer themselves. Go right ahead.
Okay. What percentage of college students get to play sports? Also, what percentage of people get to do what they really like? Okay. Not as many as we'd like to think. But anyway, my comment is, in the final analysis, we are talking about kids' games here. Now, none of these students paid for the stadiums, the bus trips, the airplane costs, insurance costs, the uniforms, hence any of the costs. I say any of the costs, but they do get to play. I think they should count themselves lucky and hold their tongues and just play the game. Thank you.
All right. Thanks, Daryl.
I would say two things about one. I agree with the notion that these students don't pay a lot of the cost for the activity they're doing. But that's true. They're not paying out of, you know, they're getting paid a scholarship. They're not paying a stipend to play the way, say, if you play an intramural, or not intramural, but say a rec league basketball team, or you go to the golf course, you have to pay to play. So, yes, it is a little bit, it is different there. And they are getting a benefit of being able to play. That is true. That said, I wouldn't like it if somebody came to me and said, hey, you know what? You like writing. You like writing about sports. Well, look, you get to go to games for free. You get to interview people for free. You get to write, and you don't have to pay for it. So why don't you hold your tongue, and we're going to pay you nothing this year. And good luck with your mortgage. I don't think any of us, you know, it is a game, but it's also a labor. And I don't think any of us really like being denied the possible fruits of our labors. Personally, I think it's very unfair to do that. Something that's a little bit related to his point about students not paying the cost of things is that, and this is not something I mentioned in the article, is that there is some of the value in these college sports. It isn't just generated by these athletes, even the, you know, the really spectacular ones that are going to go on and play in the pros. It is also generated by the schools themselves and sort of the sentiment and good feelings around people's various alma maters, around these, and at this point, around these schools as brands. So I actually think if you want to make an argument against players being paid, and this is being paid by the schools, not my suggestion, which is to let them be paid legally through the underground economy that already exists, you can make the argument that the schools are also generating value just by dint of their brand. But it is kind of a circular argument because then you can argue, well, these great players helped create that brand. A guy like Patrick Ewing at Georgetown or a Reggie Bush at USC or, you know, any kind of star college athlete you can think of helps generate, that helps create sort of that the brand that then becomes that school.
Thanks, Gerald, for the call. Some emails that have come in. This one from Nick in Milwaukee. Shouldn't the cheerleaders get paid, too, since they're part of the performance, bringing in so much money?
You know what? I'm all for cheerleaders. Again, I don't know if schools can afford to pay them, but if there's a booster that maybe a former cheerleader or just a wealthy booster that really likes what they do and wants to fund them or set up some partial scholarships or simply just give them a big sack of cash. I'm fine with that. I like to do it. I'd like to see them get theirs too. That's great. And again, this is a little unrelated, but you know, at the pro games, if you go to an NBA game or an NFL game, the girls are there. That's definitely a labor of love or enjoyment of being in the spotlight. They're making nothing. That's a separate issue. But I'd like to see them get paid as well.
That'd be an interesting show sometime because I don't know why people wear almost nothing and cheer. You know, it's always been a little bit. We had a women's movement here. That's my own opinion, but it'd be interesting.
Well,
interesting
there's
show.
Probably a certain psychology to that.
There is.
Probably related to, every individual is unique, but I do think that there's sort of some people are really fulfilled by performing.
Right.
Whatever that performance is, and being seen and being in the spotlight and being on stage.
Not wearing very many clothes, I know. I don't get it, but that's...
Sometimes.
Yeah. Here's an
that's definitely another show, and I'm not sure it's an NPR type topic.
Well, sure, everything is. You want to be our guest? Yeah. Here's an email from Kirk. Perhaps the time has come to get semi-professional athletes, which is what the athletes in universities are now, out of our universities. Let the NFL and NBA spend the money to develop these young people to be the stars of tomorrow, and let the universities get back to educating the vast majority of the students.
Well, let me say that my parents are both in academia. They're both professors. One's retired, one's still active. And morally, maybe more than a strong term, philosophically, ethically, I completely agree with that statement. Completely. Unfortunately, I think that horse left the barn about 100 years ago, and I don't think there's any way to put that horse back in the stable. And I don't think the universities, if the university presidents wanted to do that tomorrow, they could. They could say, you know what? We're spinning off all these big-time athletic departments. You guys are going to be your own corporations. You're not going to be nonprofit educational things anymore. Affiliate yourself with NFL and NBA teams if you can. Get what you can, grab what you can money-wise. We will take and admit your players as students at an institution if they can get in, and we want to take them in. But you're on your own. I mean, the university presidents could do that tomorrow, but they're not going to.
Because
the fact is these teams, these sports programs, create a lot of goodwill for these universities. They're the most effective, in some cases, they're the most effective marketing tool these universities have, and the most effective marketing tools they'll probably ever figure out how to create.
Right.
So, like I said, I agree so much of that sentiment, but it's too late. We need a time machine to go back to, like, the birth of intercollegiate athletics and start over. And can't do that. At least not that.
Kathy in Stoughton, hi.
Hi there, Kathleen. Hi there, Patrick. I am a graduate of Western Michigan, which is a mid-major school, and I would like to comment more on college football and, frankly, the safety of the players and the kind of paydays that these mid-majors are getting from, say, Big Ten, SEC, and things like that.
Mm-hmm.
We'll say that as far as the football goes, these mid-majors are booking games with these larger conferences for a huge payday, And you sit there and you watch these games, and there's such a size discrepancy. These poor players are just out there for bait, you mm-hmm. know, and so the university can get a payday to make ends meet. Mm-hmm. So,
Patrick, what do you think?
Well, I would say she's 100% right. All you need is a pair of eyes and to turn on one of these sort of payday games. They're usually in the first third of the season to see that. And that speaks, that's definitely, conservation speaks to what I was saying earlier about how there already is not a level playing field in college sports whatsoever. Not financially, not in terms of talent. There are the big schools and there's the rest. And the big school isn't always the school with the biggest enrollment or the school with the fanciest facilities or the most expensive coach. It's usually the school that just has sort of the great tradition in its program, attracts the best talent, and, you know, a lot of times it has the most fanatical fan base. In terms of what can be done, I'm not sure that's necessarily what she's describing. I'm not sure it's necessarily a problem because it's these mid-major type schools, they need those paydays. And for the large schools, sort of bringing in a sacrificial lamb a few times a year and paying them pretty generously to come play them, usually on their home field and usually for some sort of homecoming game or something like that. It's kind of a good financial arrangement for both sides. It may not produce the most competitive football on the field, but that's the whole point.
Thanks, Kathy. Ann in Eau Claire. Hi.
Hi. Our daughter played college basketball,
mm-hmm.
and there were unrealistic expectations with regard to running. The
mm-hmm.
coach demanded unrealistic expectations with regard to working out. Almost
mm-hmm.
every player had injuries because the coach demanded these intense yet mm-hmm. unrealistic workouts. I mean, this was Division III. There
wow.
was no compensation.
Mm-hmm.
There was no scholarship here.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, the basketball court, I've said, is a very big stage, but these players pay a very high price. And that's my comment.
Well, what do you think should be what should be different, Anne?
Well, I'm not really sure that athletic trainers are aware of what our athletic directors are aware of the intensity of this play, and I think that girls they're drawn into this, and the coaches make unreal promises. And the coaches really aren't that same person necessarily. I mean, that was our experience. The coach really wasn't representative of the person that she really is. I didn't agree with these really intense workouts. I mean, they'd come home late.
Sure.
The coach would demand a 5 a.m. workout if they lost.
Mm-hmm.
She would absolutely scream at them if they lost. I mean, and she didn't do this in front of people, and she certainly didn't do it in front of sponsors, but
sure.
she certainly did it to the
mm-hmm.
girls.
Patrick.
I mean, this, you know, it breaks my heart to hear that, and it's not an uncommon story whatsoever. That's a common, when you say it was Division III and it wasn't even a big-time kind of thing, that's what you're describing, that's almost irrelevant. Anything that's competitive, you end up at least sometimes getting people like this coach or situations like this where people will do anything to try to win, anything they think is going to help them win. And you know, I think this speaks to a couple of things. It definitely speaks to my earlier point about how it really is like a full-time and a very demanding full-time, like I'm talking, you know, building a skyscraper, construction work, mining in the coal, you know, maybe not like coal mining, but very physically demanding full-time job to be a college athlete at any level. And secondly, it speaks to, like I said, this competitive pressure kind of creates this sort of monster, if you will. With coaches, a lot of times the experience of the player once they get there is going to be different than when they're being recruited. And it's kind of a bait and switch, but that's true for a lot of us too when we get into the working world. If we're trying to get a job and a company seems one way and then you work there for a while and it seems another way. I wish there was an answer to what she's describing, but I'm not sure there is outside of you know, in her case, probably parents getting involved, players getting involved, maybe the players taking a stand for themselves, which is incredibly difficult for players to do, by the way. In the mid-90s, this is a little bit of a digression, but it's related. A bunch of college basketball players reportedly were talking about staging like some sort of like basically walk off the court thing.
Oh, really?
They weren't getting paid. Yeah, this was also on a recent HBO special that was really good.
Huh.
Now it never actually happened because they sort of chickened out in the end because there's just so much pressure to not do that. And you know, in division, you know, our caller was describing her daughter not being on scholarship. Well, imagine if you're on scholarship. And that scholarship's year to year, and you try something like that. I mean, what happens? What if this coach of the school just yanks your scholarship? And the thing to remember in college sports right now is the coaches and the institutions have all the leverage. The player has all the leverage right up to the point where they sign a letter of intent, a binding letter of intent, which is another ridiculous sign of legal thing, to go to a school to play for them. As soon as they're at that school doing that, then the coach and this institution has all the leverage.
Right. More phone calls in a moment. Our guest this hour is Patrick Ruby. He is a contributor to ESPN. He's a journalist. He has written a very interesting article in the current issue of The Atlantic, which you can find online. It is titled, Should College Athletes Get Paid? Ending the Debate Once and for All. What do you think? We have one line. No, we don't. We have two lines open now. 800-486-8655. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Returning to phone calls now, Rebecca from Milwaukee. Hi, Rebecca.
Hi, Kathleen. I'm a Division III NCAA basketball coach. I also played in college myself. And I also teach a sports psychology course.
Oh.
And your guest, this topic is so timely. We actually just had a class debate about this topic last week.
Oh.
Many of the students who were involved in both sides of the debate are college athletes. And, you know, one of the opening statements from one of the teams was in favor of, you know, athletes getting paid at the Division I level, was saying, you know, every organization that's a for-profit organization has a CEO, they have managers, and they have employees. And what organization would you, you know, would be what would be okay within an organization where they don't pay their employees? And I just wanted to know one, you know, what the guest thought of that comparison. I know from my experience. In working in large corporations, of course, it's not the exact same comparable because you have sort of an assumption that these student athletes are going to college to get an education. And I guess on one side of the argument, my thoughts are, if you've ever watched any of the Fab Five documentary or the LeBron James documentary, these kids are getting recruited when they're, you know, in fifth grade, sixth grade sometimes, signing letter of intents in their freshman year in high school. There is no mistake that many of these competitive athletes going to college are going to college for athletics, not for an education. And my last question to your speaker is, you know, what are his thoughts on the role of the NCAA? I, too, agree that legalizing some of these booster components to an athlete's sort of experience should happen. I get really upset when I hear, you know, that a student athlete, you know, signed a jersey and is punished by the NCAA because it's, you know, either taking away from the money that the NCAA could be making, or for whatever reason they just find it to be, you know, inappropriate. So that's my thoughts.
Thank you, Rebecca. I'm glad you were listening and called. Patrick.
First of all, very thoughtful call. I really appreciate that. I would say try and hit on some of her major questions. The comparison to a corporation, like she said, it's not a perfect comparison, but it is apt. And I think, you know, one thing that colleges could do also to sort of split the difference, at least a little bit. Now, this wouldn't be a tremendous amount of money, but actually this is something colleges maybe could afford to do and not necessarily cut all the sort of non-revenue sports would be make college athletics something like a work study sort of thing, where, you know, for every hour of practice and playing and traveling, or every hour you're spending, because these hours are tracked. There are NCAA limits on how much you're supposed to practice. And now these are routinely flouted and broken. But there are supposedly limits on these things that are supposed to be tracked. Make it a work study thing. So, you know, at least, you know, maybe you're not making more than the kid that works in the cafeteria, but you're making something for the time you're putting in. That would go a long way, at least to having some sort of stipend, some sort of walking around money, some cash in your pocket. And so it is true that some of these athletes come from incredibly disadvantaged backgrounds.
Right.
When I say disadvantaged, I'm being really euphemistic. They're really poor.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, for instance, I mean, look, I went to Georgetown. If you're a really poor kid that played the sport and you come to Georgetown and, you know, D.C. is one of the most expensive cities in the country and you're surrounded by wealthy, privileged sort of kids, or I'm not going to say the whole student body is like that because that's not true at all, but, you know, there's a good chunk in a lot of these schools of pretty wealthy kids. That's tough. And, you know, it'd be better than nothing to make it like a work-study thing. Again, it probably wouldn't break the bank. It'd probably be doable. It wouldn't solve at all the sort of other inducements and the other stuff that comes from the underground economy. But it is a possibility. The second thing I would say is her notion that some of these athletes are going to college for athletics. Well, yeah, they are. That's definitely the case. And again, whether that's right or wrong, it's just the reality. It's probably better to try and deal with that reality than to lament the fact that it's so. In terms of the players being able, you know, getting punished for selling a jersey or for autographing a jersey, I mean, that's exactly the kind of sort of underground economy thing I'm talking about. I don't see let's say you should talk about the Fab Five documentary. Let's say you're Chris Webber, who was a star player at Michigan on that Fab Five team. And you can be like a pro athlete and you can walk into a jersey signing or a basketball card signing and you can sit there and sign jerseys for 2 hours and make $10,000.
$10,000.
I don't know. If, you know, I'm not
oh
sure
my
you
gosh.
You might be able to make more if you're really high. If you're Jimmer Fredette at BYU, if Jimmer Fredette could walk into the BYU bookstore and sign jerseys for 2 hours in Provo, how much would that be worth?
I don't know.
When Jimmer Fredette turns into an NBA player and he goes back to Provo and does a jersey signing, how much is that going to be worth? The guy is like a demigod in that town. I think it's okay. I think it's pretty harmless if that's what people want to pay for and it makes them happy. I have no problem with people spending their money on that, and I have no problem with him profiting from that.
Jackie Robinson and did it for free.
I don't think the NCAA should have a problem either. Please go ahead.
Yeah, Jackie Robinson did it for free. The image of Jackie Robinson came to my mind, and I'm thinking mm-hmm. there's something off with all of this. There's something's off.
Well, I also think it's perfectly, if you're Jackie Robinson and you want to sign for free, I think that's great too.
But that made Jackie Robinson Jackie Robinson. That made him who he is too, you know?
Sure. I mean, he's being true to who he is. I think that's fantastic. But, you know, if you're a more, I don't, how do I say it, entrepreneurial-minded athlete, I don't think, if people are willing to pay, I don't think that's wrong.
Yeah. Rebecca, thank you so much for your call. Charlie in River Falls. Hi.
Hello.
Hi.
Thanks a lot for the show. It's a great program today. Say, I just want to make a comment and ask a question as well. I remember from my days at Georgetown, John Thompson, the basketball coach, kept a graphic metaphor of what's next for most athletes on his desk. Recall what that was, Patrick?
Deflated basketball.
Exactly. It's a faded basketball. And that was, I think, very telling for a lot of athletes. I remember well in classrooms, students in the back row, athletes, sleeping. And you know, at some point, it's not time to sort of call an end to the charade of student athletes and move on to maybe like a D3 model. I have a son that runs at Bates College. He's also a biochem major. And NESCAC, the New England Small College Athletic Conference, really has part of their culture, academics first, athletics second. Scheduling, sort of just the culture that's fostered by the NESCAC conference. I wondered if that sort of model would better fit more colleges and universities, and if we couldn't maybe for the big places like the Ohio States of this world, tease them out and have them maybe start a corporation or run like a minor league team Or just, again, call a spade on this.
All right, we have a minute left. Patrick?
I think that's a very prescient idea, and I do think that in the future, to spin this forward, you very may well see more schools go to sort of that D3 model, and the really big money, big time schools sort of split off into some sort of like super conference, almost professional, you know, quasi semi pro kind of status. Because I do think the current status quo is untenable in the long term. And you're starting to see the cracks in it now, and I think those are only going to get bigger and bigger as the money gets bigger and bigger.
Hmm.
Very good comment. Very good question.
Oh, you Georgetown guys are smart, right? Patrick, thank you so much. It was really an interesting hour. Thank you.
Thank you. It was terrific. I'm happy to be back anytime.
Okay, great. We'll hold you to that. Patrick Ruby, journalist and contributor to ESPN.com. You can find his article on just what we were talking about. Should college athletes get paid? Ending the debate once and for all. It's theatlanticmonthly.com. And if you go there it will be. Thanks to Chrissy Pease for producing this hour, and thanks to Chrissy Pease for on-air production here in our downtown Milwaukee studios. Thanks, everybody, for all of your calls. I'll be with you again on Monday morning at 9. It will be all things political, which it always is, and great conversations ahead all day long and for days and years to come, we hope, here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.